All right, let's have a meeting. My name is Tinsley, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club. For a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope that no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in a room tonight and listening later on AA Blue Chip Speakers. God's desperately in need, we'll hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. So, tonight, it's a real pleasure because a good friend of mine is telling his story. If I think about the old days when I used to hang out in bars and stuff, and somebody would walk into the bar, and I'd always be sitting there with some cronies on a bar stool, and a new guy would come in, and we'd say, what's this guy's story? But I never got to find out. But here at AA, we get to find out what the story is. We stick around long enough. So anyway, this guy goes to a lot of meetings, and he does the deal. And I'm not going to tell you what his deal is, but he's going to. And with that, I give you Mickey.
My name is Mickey. I'm an alcoholic, and my sobriety date is July 25th, 2012. And so I'm a linear guy. I'm going to start from the start. I was born in Tampa, Florida, June 10th, 1978. Working class family. My dad is a firefighter or retired, and my mother is a nurse. Had a wonderful childhood. I am the third of five children, first boy. Was definitely coddled by my sisters and my mother growing up. My parents really strove hard to kind of give us an idyllic childhood, but you know, our life was not without some, you know, a little bit of craziness. Everybody's family has some craziness. My father's an alcoholic. My mother is the adult child of an alcoholic as well. So I definitely get quirks from both sides. My parents worked really hard to have my mother stay at home while I was young. My dad actually held four jobs. Like when I first remembered, he was working at the fire station. He delivered packages for Emory Worldwide. He was a security guard at the Hilton, and he worked late nights at a very high-end steak restaurant where I grew up in Tampa. And so my first real memories of my father are of him either being at work or being taking a nap because he was about to go to work, or sitting in his recliner drinking beer. He had a very positive and negative impact on my life. He's a very devout Catholic, and I definitely learned morality where I grew up. But I think one of the first memories of him also is my mother took my older sisters to Girl Scout camp, and he was taking care of me, and I spilled some cereal in the morning, spilled milk all over the place, and he went absolutely ballistic. I'm sure he was tired. I'm sure some of it had to do with my four-year-old perception of what was going on. But from that point on, I was like deathly afraid of my father. I was really happy when he was at the fire station because they worked 24 hours on and 48 off. So that was something that really affected me in childhood. Now, my therapist says that it goes on before that into the womb, but you know, who knows? That's what I remember. Went to private school until the eighth grade, Catholic school. It was the hardest school I ever went to. The longest paper I ever wrote was in the eighth grade, and it was very difficult on me because I have learning disabilities, and I really didn't even know that till I was about 27. So I didn't really like school that much. I was always doing just okay. You know, I was always told, just get C's, you'll be all right. I think that as a child, the first thing that I ever lost myself in, or like similar to alcoholism, was sports. I was an excellent athlete. And I never had problems making friends, because when you're, the best athlete around, everybody wants you on their team. I would just lose myself in that. You know, playing outside as a kid, you know, where I grew up, we knocked on each other's doors and said, hey, you know, can Scott play? It's just kind of super middle class, you know, working people neighborhood. That kind of started where I would like begin my little lying. It would be like, you know, everybody develops their, survival skills. So, you know, did you do your homework? Of course I did my homework. Did you break that? No, I didn't break that. And it's, developed a pattern of, you know, just lying to save my ass, so to speak. And I catch myself doing it to this day at work, making things not as bad as they should be, even though they're really not that bad anyways. So I work on that every day. So school was hard. I was good at sports. I went to high school, went to public school. Tried out for the football team as a freshman. I made it. Turns out I was really good. I was a 4-year starter in high school. Never really drank in high school. I think the first time I got drunk, I was 12 or 13, but it was not like the moment, so to speak. That came later in life. Because my father was very hard on me. He knew that he didn't want me to be like him, so he was like on top of me. My curfew was, you know, always earlier than everybody else's. And I was scared of him, because I knew if I went against him, there was going to be a lot of screaming. I never got beat, but the screaming was epic, and I still to this day not seen anybody get as angry as I've seen my father get. Now, I'm not saying it doesn't happen behind closed doors, because it probably does, but that I don't like yelling. Turns out I was pretty good. School got easier, for sure. Public school is a joke compared to private school. I was able to, you know, go to class and do the things that I needed to do, and it wasn't too difficult on me. But those 4 years were actually fondest memories I have of being with my father, because he was there every step of the way. We trained together almost every day. He was at, I can probably count on my two hands how many practices he missed, let alone, you know, not even thinking of a game. And again, I lost myself into athletics. Wasn't a great student, but I was okay. And had a lot of fun. Didn't really get in any trouble. You know, had a pretty all-American childhood. I think later in life I asked my parents together, like, you know, why didn't you tell me the world was so, you know, bad? You know, I grew up in this cocoon. And they said, well, you know, we didn't want you to grow up thinking that everybody in this world is bad or evil or going to lie to you. Because it's not true. There's good people everywhere. There's good rich people. There's good poor people. And there's bad rich people and bad poor people. So it was kind of eye-opening, because I was upset that you didn't tell me this, you know, prepare me for the world like that. High school, and then I earned a college scholarship. I played Division I football at Louisiana Tech. When I went, it was evident, you know, I was pretty good. I started some games as a true freshman. This is where the craziness starts. I got up to Louisiana in August of 1997. I was 19 years old. I was so excited because I was just ready to leave my household, get away from my dad, just get away from the family, get away from just Tampa in general. It's a, you know, it's not a big town. It's a small town, like old Tampa. I was just ready to go. So I got there. I'm in camp for 3 weeks. I'm like the only guy who's not, me and a couple of Samoan guys are the only freshmen who are not like in driving distance from home. So our first weekend, we get off. One of the, I played defensive line. One of the upperclassmen said, okay, I'm going to come pick you up at your dorm. We had practice in the morning. I'm going to pick you up at 1:30. Adrian Fredericks is having a party. So we get to this party. It's, you know, just a party. Alcohol, barbecuing. I remember one of the black defensive linemen was barbecuing chicken, and he was showing me his special barbecue sauce that his mom taught him. They put grape jelly in it and cook it on the grill, and ended up just getting, you know, absolutely blasted. Stayed out till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. Got into a huge fight with a bunch of KAs. I think 6 of them went to the hospital. That's when I had the come to Jesus moment. I was free. I could do whatever I wanted. I didn't have to think about any consequences as far as like my dad going crazy because he was not there. He was gone. I went to a small Division I school. There was so many perks and so many things that made you special that I can't even imagine, like, you know, Georgia or Florida or Alabama. You know, we were the team that went to those schools and got their ass kicked. But we were pretty good when I was there. I played with some good athletes. And most of the people there were either too small for their position, which was me. I was undersized. You were a Prop 48, which basically means you didn't graduate high school. And you had to take a bunch of remedial classes, or you were a misfit. Somehow you'd been arrested during high school, law trouble. Pretty much everybody had a chip on their shoulder one way or another. We get into the season, and I met this guy who wasn't in, he wasn't in camp because he had gotten into a fight and knocked all the teeth out of our backup quarterback, his mouth, just before camp started. He was from New Orleans. He had been on his own since he was 14 or 15 years old. He was like nothing I'd ever seen in my life before. He showed me a world that I never knew existed, and I soaked it all up. Everything you can think of, from guns to drugs to violence to women to alcohol to, you know, dog fighting. It was crazy, and I don't even know what I was doing. All I know is that I could drink and I could do anything I wanted and nobody would question it. And I loved the adrenaline of you know, being around people like that. It's a huge high. It's kind of undescribable. It was just a debaucherous 4 or 5 years. Needless to say, my drinking increased. I was, by the end of my first year, I was drinking every day, and you know, smoking weed every day. And it was just, it was a lot of fun. It was fun at the expense of my schooling, a football career. You know, I didn't do my best, so I know, you know, I don't know what could have been. You know, I was pretty good. I was always able to, I thought it was okay because I still got up every day. I went and worked out. I did everything I was supposed to do. The tough guy, and for you guys who know me, I'm, you know, I'm no tough guy. Oh yeah, but you don't want to cross me though. I'm a tooth chipper. So. you know, it was fun. At the end, I ended up blowing out my knee, and I left school with about 22 semesters, basically, two quarters left. I remember I was just out of my mind on King alcohol, of course, and then everything else that, you know, goes with it. Most generally, anything that would allow me to stay up so I could drink more, because I love drinking beer. Loved it. So it was a fun time of life. But then when I hurt my knee, you know, I never finished school. I was going to school for general studies, so there was no, you know, it wasn't like I was an engineer or a lawyer or a doctor, you know, so I had like no clue what I was going to do. The only thing I knew that I could do good for sure was get fucked up and have a party, organize people to have a party, get people together. Learned how to manipulate people. You know, I learned a lot there. I learned about the world, which is not necessarily good. Left school, went home. I was home for like 2 months. I was a security guard. I was the worst security guard ever. I would work the night shift and take the truck and go sleep in the truck at the Florida State Fairgrounds. And then a childhood friend of mine, he was up here in Atlanta. He was working for a marketing firm that did event marketing for Pepsi, and they traveled around with NASCAR doing Jeff Gordon Pepsi stuff. Back then it was Jeremy Mayfield Mountain Dew stuff. And he said, "Hey, I need somebody to go on the road with. You want to come with me?" I was like, "Yeah, yeah." And it paid good. It was a good job, and paid real good. So I moved up to Atlanta in March of 2002. So I've been here 12 years. Went on a road with my childhood friend, and we were on the road for like the next 2 years. But it just so happens that the company that I worked for was a small, you know, it was a pretty small marketing firm. There was probably only like 40 people when I got there. But, you know, we had some big clients, and the best part about it is that both of the vice president and the president and the president's wife, they were all alcoholics. And it was like April. I had gone to Texas and then came back, and they took us to the opening game. It was like a Friday night for the Braves. And they rented a bus, and they took everybody who was in town and bought all everybody drinks. And my buddy that I knew, he was not there. He was out on the road. And I was like, I called him. I was like, "Dude, Andy and Eric are getting smashed, man." And he was like, "Oh, yeah." He was like, "They drink. It's okay. As long as you get your work done, it's okay. It's okay." By this time, I'd stopped using any alternative substances. At the end of my college, I just was so whacked out, and I thought it was the drugs, but I learned later it was not. So right about this time is when I learned that, you know, I didn't need all that other stuff to get where I was going. I just knew I had to drink more, and it's my favorite, one of my favorite quotes from a movie is Cat on a Tin Roof, when the father asks Brick, you know, how much are you going to drink? And he says, "Until the switch in my head goes off." You know, that's how I drink every time. I wasn't a huge blackout person, but I did blackout probably once a month, and I was good for doing something really stupid at least once a month. I would go in the bathroom and talk to myself in the mirror and be like, "It's 2:30. You're okay." You know, just to like, pretend, you know, like make some kind of time, you know, association so that I would like not do anything retarded. I shouldn't have said that. No, it's not funny. Shouldn't have done anything stupid. But so that continued on, just a lifestyle, being on the road, drinking with your bosses. Even if you did something retarded in front of them, I mean stupid, they didn't care. I mean, if you got your work done and you were good at what you did, it was fine. So that continued for, let's see, I worked for them until 2007. So in 2006, I fell in love with a, you know, beautiful, smart, just a really good woman. We had a kind of a, just a whirlwind love affair. She was from Peru. She was over here working actually with my company. And she was related to the owners. And so that started a just a, like, I was there, she was here, I was there, she was there. And let's see, we started dating July, August of 2005, and we were married in January 2007. You know, obviously, you guys know what Peru is famous for. Their culture is different than ours. It's actually a lot similar to how it is in Louisiana, where it doesn't matter what you're doing, what the party is. You know, there's always, you know, alcohol involved. It's just more ingrained there than most places that I've been to. So that worked out well for me. You know, in that family, if you're smashed, it's okay. You know, it's accepted. So we got married and in January 2007 and moved here up to Atlanta because I had, you know, I had a job and made okay money. And so I had to go out on the road. It was February of 2007. I had to go out on the road, and my mother-in-law was, she flew in. It was the day after the Daytona 500 of 2007. I had to drive a truck and a trailer over to the Louisiana state line, meet some people that were doing some other business, and then they were going out west, and then I was going to come back to Atlanta. So my good friend who showed me, you know, all the good stuff of the world, he lived outside New Orleans, and I stopped to see him, and I had a big huge trailer. I had two race cars in there, and went out to his property, you know, hung out and, you know, caught up and whatever. And I remember, you know, and I, at this point in my life, I did not smoke weed. I was just a drinker. But I wanted to get some for my wife because I knew she did, and I knew that, you know, he had the best. And so I got, like, two little pieces, AK-47, Super Skunk, and I don't know, some other stuff. But his personal bag was like 2 pounds. I'm not joking. So I leave in this trailer, and I stopped at a, it was right on I-10. I stopped at a real small truck stop to get a Diet Mountain Dew. When I stopped in, I pulled through the thing, and there's like 3 unmarked cop cars, state police. There's like 2 sheriffs. So I was like, you know, it kind of made me nervous, but I was like, stop being paranoid. You know, don't, you know. And I said it a little bit different than that, but got in the truck, left, and as soon as I made my first moving violation, I was pulled over by the state police, and I was questioned, but I had the same answers because everything they were asking me was true. Where are you going? Who owns this? What company do you work for? You know, just in different sequences. And so finally they were like, hey, man, if you only have a little bit, we'll let you go, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, and I'm kind of naive, so I was like, yeah, I've got like 2 little pieces in my bag in the front. And about that time they slammed the cuffs on me, and not 2 minutes later there was, I couldn't even tell you how many police. And I told the guy, I was like, I told you the truth, man. I was like, is the DEA, the FBI, state police, I guess they thought I had the mother load, but I didn't. So that day was when my mother-in-law was coming to Atlanta to help my wife get settled in, the very first day. So when I called her, she was literally picking up her mother at the airport. And they had to drive and come get me out of jail, like 8 hours. So that doesn't like go over well. So that's a football career, a college education. Now we're working on destroying a marriage, all because of bad decisions I made with drugs and alcohol. And so, you know, we were pretty happily married, and you know, when I wasn't drinking, it got to the point where she would just constantly ask me, why do you drink so much? Why can't you just have one or two? And I really didn't have an answer, because I didn't know. And I got hooked in July of 2010. I got hooked in with, I was getting gout attacks real bad from my drinking. Needless to say, I haven't had a gout attack since I got sober. So I got hooked in with a doctor. I didn't have insurance for a while because I actually, that job I lost, they hired me back a year later, and I lost it again for body slamming a coworker. That's a whole another story. But, so, you know, that's the same job twice. I don't know. I'm good at making friends, and people like me, so, you know, they want to help me. It's kind of been like that my whole life. I go to the doctor, I get another job, I get insurance, I go to the doctor, and this doctor's like, oh, you have any problems? And I was like, yeah, I get these terrible gout attacks. And he was like, all right, well, we'll give you some medicine for it, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, all right, whatever. Not even thinking that he would give me pain medicine when I wasn't having a gout attack. It didn't even cross my mind, because most doctors don't do that. And he came in and was like, here's your prescriptions. And he gave me a prescription for, 60 hydrocodone. He's like, just take these when you need it. So I took all those in about 5 days, which I had. But it was, it was the answer to my prayers, because my wife didn't know. I was out of my mind. You know, the click was going off, and I wasn't drunk. So it was like an answer. Like, okay, I can do this, and I can hold it together and make her happy. So I went through those, and then about 3 weeks later, I was like, man, I kind of want some more pills. So I emailed the doctor. They have this, like, refill thing. I just said, hey, you know, I'm having a terrible gout attack and somebody stole my meds out of my backpack. Would you call me some in? I literally got an email not 15 minutes later from the nurse saying, I won't say his name, but the doctor's called your meds in. They'll be ready in about 30 minutes at your pharmacy. So I knew I had a crooked doctor, and that's just began like a cat and mouse game with me telling him I'm having gout attacks, and he pretty much provided anything that I wanted that you could call in, which is basically hydrocodone. But it started an addiction to that. And then in May, he had me on some other stuff, and I had a massive seizure, fell out, broke my back, went to the hospital, caused a lot of harm and scare to, you know, my wife. She was, terrified. She didn't know why I had a seizure. Nobody did but me, but I knew that I had overdosed on Tramadol. You know, when I was in the hospital and I realized that I wasn't going to have surgery, I was going to be okay. I was secretly happy, because I knew that I could now get hardcore pain medicine. And I could go to doctors, and it would be cheap, and it would be, comparatively to the street. That's how, like, sick my brain was. So I was like, I can still keep functioning as far as not being drunk and, still feed the beast, so to speak. So that went on. I mean, it just got out of control. And then she came to me and said, if you don't quit doing... She finally, you know, obviously she figured it out. But she said, if you don't quit doing that, I'm leaving. And so I stopped it, went through withdrawal. It was horrible. It was, you know, as all some of you sure know. But I started drinking right away. And going from... like not drinking for a year basically on the regular pattern that I had been to then, I could drink so much more than I ever could before. I mean, I could, you know, easily put down a case after work. So that started causing, you know, so it was that, now it's the drinking again. I had a drunken episode and she was like, I'm out, I'm gone. So I was grasping at straws. I came to this clubhouse, got a white chip. Like a lot of people, it was all going over my head, and I just didn't understand. I would call my alcoholic father afterward and be like, man, they talk about drinking so much. All it does is make me want to drink more. And he was like, yeah, they're just reformed drunks. She went home for a month during Christmas. I stayed here. I managed to get a couple of weeks here and there. And then when she came home, she got an apartment and left. And then that I went on a run that was just incredible. I spent a lot of money that I didn't have. I was just full of despair and sadness. And I didn't know what to do. I had no idea. I'd be drunk one day. I'd be withdrawn. You know, it was just a terrible back and forth. Just a terrible way to live. Trying to go to work, looking terrible, and feeling terrible, and just having a horrible, you know, soul sickness. And I remember just going to sleep. For about the last month, I would go to sleep, and I would say, you know, please, God, help me. That's all I would say. You know, and I'd go to sleep, and the cycle would kind of start over again. That prayer led to me contacting a family friend. My sister gave me the number. My brother-in-law knew this guy. He'd been sober 5 years. He runs Safety Net over in Smyrna. So my sister was like, I'm not giving you this number if you don't call him. You've got to promise me you're going to call this guy. So I called him. All he did was relate his story to me. I had just had enough, and I was willing to do anything. So that small prayer in desperation, you know, led me to this man who suggested that because of what I was going through, you know, you want to go to rehab. So I did, but I went to a place that was 12-step based, and they reintroduced me to AA. And they told me, if you don't go to AA, you're not going to stay sober. You've got to work the 12 steps, and it takes work to stay sober. So I'm in there about 2 weeks. I'm outside. I'm having a panic attack. I'm smoking cigarettes like crazy. I'm really upset because, you know, I'm that guy that everybody's family knows. You know, Mickey's the guy. He's a drunk. He's a drug addict. He destroyed a marriage. Was a great athlete. You know, you don't want to be like that guy. You know, it was really weighing heavy on me. I don't know. I was standing outside and just a huge wave of calm, you know, came over me. I just knew it was going to be okay. Like, it doesn't, you know, none of that matters. It was a surreal experience. I guess it was a white light experience. And that's why, for me, step two is my favorite step, because I did come to believe that a power greater than myself that I choose to call God still loves me. And it allowed me the opportunity to get sober and live a productive and happy life without alcohol and drugs, because my higher power is omnipresent, omnipotent, was before the universe, before all of us. You know, it's kind of hard to grasp, but you know, to me, that's what God is. So step two is my favorite step, and then I just knocked them all down. You know, I got a sponsor. Step three, easy. You know, and I was talking to a friend of mine last night. She was like, step four is so hard. And I said, no, it's not. I already know all the dirt. I did. Step five is hard when you got to really open up your soul and tell somebody all the bad things you did. But you learn about trust doing that. You learn about being vulnerable with another human being that's gone through a lot of the same similar things as you. It just allows you to be free of anything that you're holding in, anything that anybody did to you or you did to them. It can go both ways, because we do play victim, but we, as children, we are often victims to psychological violence, psychological damage, violence. It's good to let that stuff go. AA has completed my life so far. I'm really happy that I found AA. I found a great home group. I love NAPA. It's an awesome place. There's a lot of good people here. That's about it. I want to read. Something. I like metaphors. So this is not AA approved, but I'm going to use it as a metaphor. It's a poem that I got from. Was in our workout manual at Louisiana Tech. Every morning in Africa, a gazelle wakes up. It knows it must outrun the fastest lion, or it will be killed. And every morning in Africa, a lion wakes up, and it knows it must run faster than the slowest gazelle, or it will starve. You know, it doesn't matter whether you're a lion or a gazelle. When the sun comes up, you better be running. I used to think I was a lion, just going through stuff, destroying things. I didn't think of it as destroying them then, but just going out and getting what you wanted. But I've come to realize that I'm a gazelle, and the lion is alcoholism. Now, every morning I got to get up and do the things that are suggested to me to stay sober and live a productive life. That's my story. I'm sticking to it.
Thanks so much, Mickey. That was great. Really great.
Just another homesick child, tired of running wild, ready to stand trial and move on. Though I'm guilty in your sight, have some mercy tonight. I can't make it through this fight all alone. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt. As I try to make some sense of this world I'm up against, well, I know my best defense is your love. When the struggle gets insane and the lessons full of pain, keep me calling out your name with love. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt. Thank you. Well, I whisper in the dark from the bottom of my heart, and I'm searching for one star to shine. I will shout from mountain high, and I'll reach into the sky till you open up my eyes so blind. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt.